little bit, but we're going to go upstairs, so we'll go up there. Neurophysiology. What do we mean? Physiology of the nervous system, right? Physiology is the normal function of the nervous system. Pathology is the abnormal, right? And when you think about physiology and studying the function in the nervous system, it could be at a gross level, like an EEG, right? Or it could be intracellular recordings, or it could be at a molecular biology level, right? Gene expression, second messenger cascades. So it all depends on where you want to go with understanding the function of neurons, neurophysiology. But also the supporting cells, like glial cells. They're important, too, for the nervous system. There's more glial cells in your brain than there are neurons. It's not an insult. It's real. More glial cells in my brain, too. All right, than really neurons. And they're very helpful to functioning of those neurons to keep them going. But to understand neurophys, we have to really think about a different aspect of neurophysiology, and that's electrophysiology, and understanding the electrical field potentials as well as the potentials across the membrane to understand the function of these cells, right? So it's been a primary understanding of how the nervous system carries electrical signals, right, and communicates to other neurons or muscles or target tissues in our body. But how do we monitor those and know if they're in a physiological range or maybe pathological, something's gone amok? Well, very early recordings have been done by surface electrodes. And everybody's familiar with an EKG, for example. Leads just go on you, and you can record the heart and how it's functioning. But if you're moving around and your other muscles are working, it contaminates that electrical signal. So you're usually really relaxed. So the main muscle that you're measuring, the electric field potential, is the heart, right? It also, if you measure EEG, you can actually see the EKG inside the EEG recording. And that's always contaminating EEG recordings. It's a problem that people try to get rid of that signal. But there's ways now, algorithms that they use. So what we got here, and what you're going to be using probably in your class, is a very simple field potential on this volunteer or victim on some muscle potentials. So you can get the idea of the muscles are generating electrical potentials, your skeletal muscles, just like an EKG in your heart, and you can monitor this. We go to outreaching programs. Tori's helped with that as well, and this is with Backyard Brains. You're going to be using this in your techniques course later on. It's a free app you can get on your iPhone or iPad. Just go to Backyard Brains, a little thing like this to connect up, and it's just a differential between two leads. And what we see here, and I got a little speaker, and if we're real quiet, you see that? Flex. See? Pretty cool, right? Isn't that cool? No? Oh, I was supposed to say, wow. Okay. And you can expand it out. You can make it larger. Now try it again. And you can slow it down. And then do it again. And you can see that every time she does that. Now, she can hold that and try to maintain force. And you could actually measure that field, that potential, field potential, and how long she can keep that going until she fatigues. Right? And you've got an electrical response. And you can actually quantify that, right? And this is what they do with EMGs if you want to understand how the muscle's functioning. And not just muscle, motor nerve function. What is fatigue? When you get tired running and you're gonna you're running that marathon and you just can't go anymore, what is the problem here? Lactic acid buildup? Is that fatigue neural or is it muscular? Is it muscular? And then behind you comes a drill sergeant and says, get up, boy, run, run, run. And you have more energy to run, right? How did you get that all of a sudden? If it was a lack of energy where that cell can't function, but if someone yells behind you or shocks you with a little probe, you get up and keep running. So is fatigue really at a cellular level, a lack of energy? Or maybe lactic acid where you can't run anymore? Or is it mental? There is a mental component to fatigue. Just think of driving yourself. So you think, wow, it's not so easy to study fatigue, right? It's not even so easy to study synaptic depression. Is it postsynaptic? Is it presynaptic? A lot of issues in neuroscience that have been addressed over the years to try to get a better handle on understanding something as simple as fatigue. And you know what? Fatigue is still hard to define even today. There's different ways of doing it, trying to get an index, but is it neural? Is it muscular? Is it mental status, right? Some people are just couch potatoes and don't want to do things, right? Okay, so what we have is lots of fun things for you. So what we're going to do now is to go upstairs, and I got a prep for you, and you can stay, you can put your stuff here, but I would take your wallet. I'll lock the door so no one else can get in, okay? So let's go upstairs, and I got a prep on a rig ready for you to go, and we'll lock the door. And Tori will lead you to the lab. She knows where it's going. Come on, Tori. We're going to go up that stairway. Tori's going to lead us right into room 226 in the back. Oh, no, you can take them off. Sorry. All right, is everybody up? Can we just close this when they're done?
Throw them away?
Yes. And if it gets a little red ring and then your skin starts to drop off, you'll know what to do to that. No. I mean, but you might want to wash it a little bit later because there's some salt on it and it just gives a little irritation. Okay. No fatigue. Keep going. Why are we fatigued? Are we fatigued? Sorry. No fatigue. Come on. You know me, Tori. Come on. Come on back. Way back here in the back of the torture room. Okay. All right. Let's get everybody back here real quick. Come on around. Some people can sit here. You can go back in the cubby hole if you want to. All right. More people, cram on in. Here, you can sit. Somebody can sit, too. Get more people in that way. Have a seat. Here you go. Are we all there now? Maybe? Close to it? Getting there? Come on in. You can stand right here. You can stand there, too. So, extracellular recordings. Like we did with the skin recording just now. It's a field potential. It's just a field around the nerve. Now, you can imagine the farther away from that recording, the more difficult it is. Extracellular recordings are some of the first recordings done to understand electrical events of nerves. And you can even make your own little electrode, really simple. It's just a glass pipette, silver wire on the inside, a silver wire on the outside, plastic that we just pulled from PE tubing from Home Depot, put it on top of there and wrap it really tight with like saran wrap. And you have a little tip there, and what you do is you fill that up with saline, pass the silver wire on the inside, and have saline touching over the ground wire on the outside. So all you're doing is measuring a differential between these two wires. And what's between these two wires? Your nerve. So you're measuring the potential, the electrical events that nerve gives. You can measure the nerves in your arm just by having two electrodes. You saw how we measured the muscle potential, right? So what we've done here is to take a crayfish, one of our favorite preparations, and on the abdomen of the crayfish, the back end of it, we've taken off the abdomen and opened it up, and there's on the back of the abdomen, there are proprioceptors, neurons that monitor the movement of those segments in the back of the crayfish, right? Every time they bend, just like moving your arm. Close your eyes and you know where your arm is and you know at what rate you're moving it, right? You don't have to look at your arm to do that. That's proprioception. Sensory neurons. And where are those sensory neurons? What neurons are you using when you monitor your joint movements and you know where your fingers are? Is it ones in the joint? Or does anybody know? Anybody have a physiology before class? How do you know where your arm is moving and where are those receptors? Anybody remember? Anybody interested in allied health later on? Standardized exam questions. Okay. Any idea? Is it a joint receptor itself? Is it something in your joint? I can tell where my leg's out. I can tell where it's in. I can tell how fast I'm moving.
Joint receptors.
So what happens when... thank you for your answer. What happens when someone has a knee replacement or a hip replacement? Do they lose total understanding of where their leg is?
Yep.
No. Good idea, though. I like that confidence. They don't, actually. So the joint receptors in us aren't really telling us where our limbs are. They might be adding some extra information, but really it's the muscle spindles. It's the sensory receptors in our muscles, right? Muscle spindle organ. When they stretch or when they're pulled, they monitor the muscle movement, and that tells us higher centers where our limbs are, how fast they're moving. Well, crayfish has something very similar. It's actually the same kind of arrangement. There's one that monitors static positions. There's one that monitors dynamic movements. It's analogous to our muscle spindles. So it's been used for years, since 1960s, early on, with extracellular recordings. And some of the ideas of how our muscle spindles work actually came from the same preparation, the MRO. So you'll see that on your webpage. So what I have is a nerve pulled up into a suction electrode here. filled up with crayfish saline, and we're going to move it back and forth the little joint and just see if we can pick up some field potentials, okay? Let's see if it works. So, I got to turn on the amplifier first. And the amplifier is just a differential amplifier that amplifies the signal between those two wires. That's all it does. It just amplifies the signal between those two wires. You can actually make one with parts from Radio Shack if you want to yourself, like that backyard brain stuff. You can order it online for $35, solder it together yourself, and make your own little amplifier. Students down in Bowling Green, Kentucky, middle school students, have made those, soldered them together, and monitored what we just did today. So it's pretty cool, right? So on the screen is a recording, the output. We got an amplifier that's going into this magic box over here. This magic box over here converts it. It's an A to D analog digital converter, so it's recorded on the computer screen. So let's move that little prep and see if we get something. So you can tell me if there's things. I'm going to tell you. I am now stretching it, stretching, 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 stretching. Anything happening?
Yep.
And now it's stretching and I'm holding it. Still firing?
Yep.
So think about that. I'm holding it stretched out and it's firing. Now I'm going to let it loose. And now it's not firing anymore. I know where my arm is. Same thing. I know where my tail is. You know, I know it's out. I know it's flexed. I know at what rate I'm moving my tail, right? And this is it. I'll move it back and forth real fast versus real slow. So here's fast. Stretch, relax, stretch, relax, stretch, relax. Now I'll do it really slow. Stretch and hold and relax. So you can see the difference. The firing frequency is what tells you how fast you're moving your arm. Same thing with muscle spindles. Same thing on a crayfish admin. That's extracellular recordings. You can't really make much about the amplitude, right? Because if the nerve is tight in that thing, in that little suction plastic pipette, you'll get better signals because the resistance is higher and you don't lose the field potential. The looser it is, these signals will be a lot smaller. So there's limitations with extracellular recordings, just like the EMG that we were recording on the skin of the surface. If there wasn't good contact, maybe she had real dry skin, we wouldn't get a good signal. But on those little patch things that we put on, there was a little salt solution in there to help pick up the electrical field potentials. So it added to being able to detect it. Now, if we switch over, turn this thing off, blow that out. This is the best way to really understand is by doing. So, what we're going to do now is we have this intracellular recording electrode. This is just a silver wire on a little base that we can plug into a head stage. And that head stage is no different than that other kind of amplifier. But it's a little bit different in the sense of the electronics that are inside. Because when you're picking up a field potential, you're measuring in microvolts. Microvolts, okay? Microvolts. Very small field potentials. But when you're measuring across a membrane, what do you have? You're measuring in millivolts, right? You probably heard of resting membrane potential, like minus 60, minus 70 millivolts. And when you depolarize, you get the shape of that big action potential. That thing is 50 millivolts in amplitude, maybe. So now we're in a whole different ball game from microvolts to millivolts. So the head stage is a little bit different. But now you can think about the amplitude of those signals means something, right? Because you're across the membrane. So intracellular recordings allow you to understand more about the membrane potential and how cells are excitable or inhibited versus extracellular. It's very hard to get that same level, all right? Because you might be better seal or less seal on it. So we take this, we fill it with our magic stuff. And the magic stuff is 3 molar KCl because it's a good electrolyte. And Tori can tell you about this wonderful class that you have in the spring called Neurophysiology, which she just loved, favorite course. And we do a lot of these things. So this is a glass pipette. It's a very fine tip. It's about a micron in diameter. It's not spilling out much potassium chloride inside the cell. We put this on this little wire. And if my eyes still function, we put that on there. Tighten this up. Now we're going to stab this through the muscle fiber, and we're going to measure membrane potential, okay? And we're going to measure the membrane potential on a muscle. So I just got to change this from AC to DC. And let me put this on the head stage and get this going. This is an intracellular amplifier. So we put a ground wire in the bath. So we're measuring the difference from the ground wire to this intracellular electrode. Let me get this going. Okay. Okay, so we're in the bath. We need to zero this, so we have a zero potential between the electrode and the ground wire. Zero, because we're not inside the cell, we're just in the bath. We're going to poke inside the cell. What we see here will be the resting membrane potential. All right? That's an intracellular recording. So we just take this, take that, and we're going to stab a muscle fiber. I said we're going to stab a muscle fiber, possibly. Okay. That's 33. It should be going down more than that. So right now, this one's only 42. It's going to go down probably a little bit more. So this is minus 43 millivolts. Wow. And if we were recording that, we should see... what did I do? Oh, we have to take an output here and switch to another channel. Let me see what's going on here. This one. That was the extracellular one. So that's the intracellular. And I don't know exactly where we were. Let's see what we got here. So if we look here, we can put this little cursor up here, record our recording over here, and let me stop this for a second. And that says 15, that's not right. That's 30, let's try this. I'm gonna pull out. There's pulling out. It's at zero, let me make sure this is functioning. And we, you know, it's just one way to record. Okay, it wasn't on our zero now. Something is off. Maybe this is off. Okay. Oh, I think it's unplugged. Sorry. But anyway, it's unplugged. But you get the idea. It's the same as this. I just wanted you to see that it drops in to minus 42. But it's the same as seeing it electronically up here. So we can try it again. If anybody wants to start stabbing this thing, you're welcome to try it. Now there's 67. I just went over to a different muscle. This is probably the better recording because that's the real resting membrane potential. What if we add potassium to this? What's going to happen? It's going to depolarize, right? It's like a muscle injury. Spills out potassium, changes the equilibrium potential for potassium. All right, so we'll understand that as we go back down and look over some wonderful PowerPoint slides. All right, but you get the idea of intracellular, extracellular limitations and what you can do with it, right? Getting real membrane potential values. All right. Let's go get back to torturing. Isn't that great?
So much fun.
So much fun. You got to see recordings. And I got you moving.
You should have made some snack.
Yeah, there you go. Fitbit recording. But, you know, they could be doing these intracellulars in the lab part, too, right? Got all the equipment there.
You know. Nothing.
No. In the muscle, it's easy. Right? Oh, yes.
I broke so many electrodes. Dabbed myself in the hand.
Good for you. So, does that help?
Yeah.
I think seeing is believing. Oh, you poor soul. Okay. You'll love it. Oops, sorry, I forgot it was locked. Okay. All your stuff is safe. There you go. Go for it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Caffeine kicking in yet? No? You didn't do your caffeine? Okay. Here we go. So those preps are there with video recordings and all that kind of stuff if you're interested. It's all there. Okay, so this is on Echo 360 as well as on a podcast, so you'll all get this. So let's think about electrophysiology and neurophysiology in general. Some of these early recordings you might have heard of or seen it in your high school textbook even, but now you might have a little more appreciation of some of these field potentials that they were monitoring and some of the early bioelectricity experiments. And you probably heard of the story before by Volta. He was recording the electrical responses, or actually seeing the response of the electrical stimulation of a frog nerve and seeing that the frog muscle twitched. Anybody ever cook frog legs? Yeah, it's great. I'm from West Texas. We used to go bullfrog hunting all the time. Great stuff. And you'd see them, you know, kicking in the frying pan. You got to put the lid on, right, so they don't kick it out. But his experiment's actually by Galvani. So, you know, galvanic current, you heard from your physics class. It's named after Galvani. And this is way back when, right, 1700s, back when I was born. And what he actually was actually stimulated by Benjamin Franklin's recordings with recording electricity by lightning strikes and understanding electricity. So he actually set up a device to try to get electrical activity by lightning. And then that wire would go to his preparation to generate the electricity to stimulate his frog prep. Isn't that amazing? So it kind of combined Benjamin Franklin's ideas of electricity with actually bioelectricity and stimulating the frog muscle. This guy, Volta, they're both Italians, but Volta didn't believe Galvani earlier on that he could actually get electricity to stimulate the frog muscle. And so Volta did more experiments and actually then reproduced a lot of Galvani's work and presented this. So Volta, you know, Volts that you remember from your physics, this is named after him. So these are pioneers in the physics field, but also in bioelectricity and understanding a lot about electrical events, because they didn't understand how the body moved and how electricity, if it really was electrical events or not. So that's kind of interesting. This is some of his classic experiments that you might have seen in textbooks. They took dissimilar metals, could touch the dissimilar metals, that would make a spark, then that would stimulate that nerve and make this muscle contract. If they put another nerve on top of this muscle but damaged it a little bit so ions would leak out when it contracts, it would stimulate this other nerve, and that's how they got to the idea of electrical conduction in these nerves, and that's what these nerves were doing, conducting electrical impulses, and that could then stimulate the preparations. So these, from these early experiments in the 1700s, wow, it's a long time ago, right? Not much happened for a good while after that. They just kept doing these same kind of experiments over and over again. And it wasn't until really Sidney Ringer came around and developed what do we call it, the Ringer solution today, right? And that Ringer solution today is what goes in your IVs for your lactate Ringer, for example. And he was playing around with the right salts to actually keep frog hearts alive so they could do experiments. And that was actually very interesting. If you go to Wikipedia, it's kind of like by accident he found out calcium was important. So serendipitously he found out, you know, what ions were really important for that. At that same time, in France, around the early 1800s, they actually, because of the recordings that the frog saline that was developed, and some of the first preparations in understanding fatigue that we were talking about, repetitive muscle stimulation by the nerve, was done in a preparation called the Crates preparation. Amazing. So there was this physician that was teaching at the University of Paris, and he actually did experiments on the crayfish preparation to measure tension with repetitive stimulation and actually seeing how the muscle contracted and would stay contracted. And he would do the experiments in his lab, write it up and show the results, and then present it to his medical physiology class and showing that these are how these preparations work. And he made these discoveries. He was also doing primary research, but he made these discoveries to teach it to his med school class. Guess how he did the electrical shocks? You think he plugged it into the wall and could just turn on the stimulator? Static electricity. He would build up these things with static electricity and put them together to make the shocks. I mean, amazing things that these people did a long time ago to do this kind of work. Phenomenal. There's a book called Galvani Spark. You can get it off of Amazon.com. It's relatively cheap now. If you buy the initial version, it's kind of expensive, but you can get some cheap versions now. Galvani Spark. It talks about the history of neurophysiology from the very beginning to the end and some pretty cool stuff that they were doing. So how are our cells excitable? How can you have an excitable cell? You know, how can a cell be excitable? What do we mean by excitable? We mean, you know, electrically excitable in our terms of neurobiology, but it could be excitable to turn on some cascade inside that cell. But generally, when we talk about excitability, we mean electrical excitable. How can you have a cell to be electrically excitable? How do you make it where it's going to have electricity? Ion movement. So that means to have ion movement, you have to have a gradient. You have to have something that will drive it. So a common example, in every cell in your body is a little bit different. And you're different than the crayfish and a squid or a seawater animal. But generally, it's the same kind of proportion. That sodium is low on the inside, high on the outside. Potassium is high on the inside and low on the outside. And calcium is high on the outside. That's a general scenario. Now, these absolute values, completely different if you're a seawater critter or you're a freshwater critter or an amphibian or a mammal. And even in your body, these ion differences are different depending on the cell that we're talking about. So it's kind of interesting to think about. Now that you have a gradient, if you opened up channels here, you could say, well, the concentration gradient is high over here for sodium, and it's going to go in across the membrane, or high here for potassium, wants to go out this way. But there's something else besides just the chemical gradient we have to think about, and that's the electrical gradient. So it's a chemical-electrical gradient, the two together, that drives ion movement. Okay, it's not just the concentration gradient. It's a chemical-electrical gradient. If you kind of look at some of these values for different animals, and particularly the squid nerve, because that's where a lot of the primary work came. We can credit these people in the 1950s for where we are today, really, in neurophysiology. Because if they hadn't worked with that squid prep, and we just discovered it today, we would be archaic in our understanding of how our body functions, neurons function, muscles function, heart functions, everything. But they were very lucky because they found the squid nerve, and they actually initially thought it was a tendon. And then they realized, well, but if we stimulate it, it makes the mantle move. So maybe it's like that Volta's frog experiments. Maybe it actually conducts electricity. And then they kind of started to investigate it more. They can dissect it out of the squid. It's about the size of your pinky, actually. It's actually fused neurons that comes together in embryological development. About the size of your pinky. You can take it, and you can roll it like a toothpaste tube, and you can roll out the cytoplasm. Remember, the cytoplasm is just not water in there. It's a matrix. So it comes out like toothpaste. And people have done this for many years. There were undergraduates working from Boston University down at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts, and that's all they would do in the summer, is roll squid axons and push out the cytoplasm, put them on little slides so they could look at movement of vesicles or how dynein and kinesin or how those motors would work and move organelles up and down the axon. But what these people did a long time ago in the 1950s, Hodgkin, Huxley, Katz, A.V. Hill, these are the gods in the field, you just like, you know, bow to hear their name. It's like, okay. So these guys, what they did is they took that squid nerve, squished out the cytoplasm, tied off one end, put an electrode on the inside, tied off the other end, but they could inject different solutions on the inside. So now they could vary the intracellular concentration of a cell and then see what happens to ion movement or excitability. So it was phenomenal. Squid prep was phenomenal for being able to do this. And we owe so much for this understanding of how the action potential comes about by the work that was done in the squid. But notice again, intracellular, potassium's high, sodium's low. Extracellular, whoa, sodium's high, potassium's low. If you look at the frog, we're very close to the frog. Sodium, much lower on the inside. Potassium, you know, high, but big difference from a seawater animal than us. And then again, the difference. The difference here was really quite fortuitous because when they did these squid preparations, guess what they used for their saline? Seawater. They just took seawater and put it in a dish and put their squid preparation in there, and we're lucky that it worked out the way it is. Seawater is very close to these ion concentrations, so their prep lived. And they could do experiments. Amazing. It was really just by accident. It actually worked out so well for them and for us to benefit from their experiments. So it's really quite neat to think about. And when we think about ion movement, when we're talking about it like electrical signals, we're talking about very fast conduction, right? We're talking about ions going through a channel very quickly, not something transported slowly across the cell membrane. are just not right across the membrane itself, right? These ions don't just move through the bilipid membrane. They go through channels. And these channels have to open or close. They can be driven by a neurotransmitter. They can be driven by voltage. But you have some cells, that are, most of the cells in your body, have some channels that are just there that are open all the time. They're called leak channels. And they primarily allow sodium and potassium through the, through their channel. So if you have leak channels, then if you change the ion concentration, that's going to be driven to go, you know, across that cell. If they're open all the time, called leak channels, right? So you could drive an ion to move across the cell. When you have electrical signals, like sodium going into the cell and potassium going out, how much can it keep on going, right? There's going to be some limit. The cell's going to fill up with sodium. It's going to be depleted of potassium, right? Well, what happens? How do you get that balance back? Anybody? Yes, this thing. So right now, you at rest, it's not moving too much, maybe sleeping, that's okay. If you're just at rest, think about the majority of energy utilized in your body right now. Where is it going? It's actually going to maintain this ion balance. Your brain, your heart, your eye, think of your retina. That optic nerve has a million neurons in it. It's very active, right? Just seeing these colors. Your brain, it's active. And your heart to keep moving. And you think, those are ions going in, and how is it going to get rebalanced? Sodium, potassium pump. So probably the majority of energy right now utilized by your body, if you're not digesting lunch, is probably to drive this sodium, potassium pump. So that's pretty amazing to think about. If you poison that pump, you're not going to last very long. If you poison your mitochondria, how do you poison your mitochondria? Cyanide, for example, or hypoxia, right? Hold your breath and see how long you can hold your breath, right? Not that long, right? And it's because of the oxygen deprivation, but also pH is the main driver that makes you breathe. It's not hypoxia, it's really pH that drops. But if you put plastic on it, how long do you think you're going to survive before you pass out? And that all comes due to not being able to maintain an ion balance because you don't make enough ATP from your electron transport chain, and you're not making ATP, you can't keep that pump going. And that's what really will kill you. Because if you can't get your intercostal muscles to breathe in and out and your diaphragm to work, you're not breathing. So then it just goes more and more, right? So you think about how important this pump is, but how important it is to maintain this electrical balance so you can keep cells excitable, so you can excite the nerves, so you can excite the muscles, so you can keep breathing and function. Okay, so pores, these are channels. And some of them stay open, some of them are controlled by different factors like voltage. It's amazing. These are proteins made up of amino acids, and you wonder, how could it have a voltage sensitivity to it? How could a protein have voltage sensitivity to it? How can it detect the membrane potential? And if that changes, it will open. Any ideas? How can that protein, how can that channel detect? It is from conformational change, but what induces that conformational change is that electrical change. You're right on. But how does it detect that electrical change? Good thinking. An active site in the protein. And what is this active site that we're thinking about? If we're talking about electrical change. What are gates? What are those gates made out of? Metal big gates open, close. Ligands. You're getting there. What is this channel made out of? Amino acids. And charged amino acids, positive or negative amino acids, right? So depending on the makeup of the amino acids in here, they are the gates. If you have negative ones up here and positive ones down here, and this is inside the cell, let's say, if inside the cell is negative, the positive is attracted, right? But depolarize this, allow this to become positive now, and what's it going to do to that positive charge? It's going to want to move out of the way. And if this becomes negative quickly by electrical signals coming down, then you've changed the conformational change, and you can open up a channel. So it's the makeup of these channels, the amino acid makeup, that makes them voltage sensitive. And at what level of voltage sensitivity? And then the makeup of those amino acids, how big the channel is. So it has selectivity based on the amino acid structure. And that selectivity can also be what? If there's a lot of negative charges in here, does it want to have a negative ion come in? No, it's going to repel it. If they're positive charges, it's going to attract a negative ion, like chloride, right? But if you think about this, it's kind of interesting. So let's say it attracts a negative chloride in here. They're all positive charges, so the chloride comes in. But then how does it get out the other side if it's attracted in here? So these are kind of questions that a whole field works on. They spend their entire lives working on. These are membrane biophysicists. And all they do is study ion channels and how they work. And they make up proteins and they put those in channels and they want to know how they work. And why is this interesting? They're kind of nerds. They're physics, biology nerds, right? And they're kind of really very into the channels, but they make artificial channels. But not only that, they understand the defects in ion channels. If these are proteins, they're made from amino acids, what coded for that protein? The DNA. The mRNA from the DNA, right? So all that. So think about every protein in your body, every enzyme in your body, every protein in your body being coded, right? Think of a gene mutation. One substitution could change a key element in the amino acid sequence here to make this channel not sense the appropriate voltage anymore to open or not have the right pore. Night blindness is a calcium channel mutation. Many abortions that occur spontaneously, now they can check, get that tissue from it, they find out it's probably due to ion channel pathologies. So they're very interested in understanding why, you know, you have spontaneous abortions in humans. And if, just by the way, to put that out there, from fertilizations where you test, you know, positive on the little plus thing, right, and to carrying it to term, over 50% of human fertilizations end up in abortions. Spontaneously, not induced. Spontaneously. And you wonder why. Well, if your calcium channel is not working, is your heart going to be functioning right? Is your nervous system going to develop right? No. So you see how important these channels are for the tissue to develop right and function right. Question? Yes. Fluoride channels. Exactly. And this is one of the first diseases or conditions that were actually used in being treated in Italy by gene therapy. And so when you think about gene therapy and utilizing tissue and stem cell research, think about it when you vote, because all that actually implies what we can do and not do with neurobiology or treating diseases like cystic fibrosis or Alzheimer's or other things. But channel pathologies, to understand more of it, you have to understand how the channel's working. You have to appreciate the biophysicists that make these mutations and compare it and then try to correct genes that would actually be defective. And, you know, a lot of kids probably die from these situations. And there's some diseases where you'll be able to function, get along, but then any stressor that you have, your nervous system shuts down. Or epilepsy. What does epilepsy do to? What's the mechanism due to epilepsy? Anybody know? Something that's common in our society, relatively? What's the mechanism, the detailed mechanism? Why is it the nervous system starts to fire? It could be part of it. But if we knew that, absolutely, couldn't we just solve that problem? Maybe with some treatment? Firing of neurons. But what stimulates them to fire? Why are they firing and not other neurons? Why is there a focal point and then it spreads? What's the deal with it? Why is it doing that? Why not everybody doing it? What's wrong with it? And this is it. You know, there's lots of little things and there's a lot of differences. And sometimes injury, if you have an injury or surgery or a brain injury, that can form scar tissue and there's more epileptic seizures due to that scar tissue. But what's the mechanism behind it? Why is it doing that? Why do some people have odd personalities and some functioning right? You know, is the nervous system connections right? Something wrong? You know? It's a lot of interesting things, right, from connections to the mechanisms of how the channels themselves work. So it's kind of neat when you think of these channels and selectivity. It's not just the size of the ion, but it's also the charge of the ion, right? But then that also relates to the charge of that pore, right? That's going to influence ions going through. So you can get a lithium to go through a sodium channel really easily, and you can get lithium to go through a potassium channel, but you won't get chloride to go through these channels very well. So it's kind of interesting, and this is what people have looked at for many years. There's another type of communication, not that common in us, in our brain, but through gap junctions. There is a spot in our brain, the superior olive. It's not well understood what that region in our brain does. It does send projections up to the cerebellum. But in that region, we have gap junctions. It's weird. Where else in your body might you have gap junctions? that are very necessary.
Muscles?
What kind of muscles? Do you think skeletal muscle?
Yes.
Not too many on the skeletal muscle, but it's a good idea. Some muscle, smooth muscle. There's different types of smooth muscle. There's multi-unit smooth muscle, and then there's single-unit smooth muscle. Single unit functioning together like a syncytium because there's gap junctions. So you stimulate this one, they all get stimulated together. You need those in our GI tract for peristalsis. Also your liver. In the invertebrates, you see a lot of gap junctions in their neural circuit. For what? Fast neural communication. Because if you have a gap junction, electricity can travel very quickly through there, right? It's big enough to allow ions to move across there, but not big molecules. Some small molecules can go across, like some single amino acids as well. So it's really interesting. That tail that we were talking about in the crayfish, the tail, touch the tail, watch a tail flip, right? That's really neat when you think about neural circuits. Now, this is why I love PowerPoint, because my drawings are horrible. But anyways, let's see if I can find a marker that might work. Okay. Okay, so here's the crayfish tail. Actually, if you touch a crayfish on the tail, tail flips, right? Tail flip, tail flip, tail flip, tail flip. How does it do that? Sensory neurons that you touched on the tail, it will tail flip. So these sensory neurons project to a ventral nerve cord. So they send their projections into the ventral nerve cord. It's like the spinal cord in us, ventral nerve cord. And they send their projections onto an interneuron. An interneuron receives that information. This is chemical. And it's acetylcholine as a transmitter. Okay, that interneuron now, which runs up the animal, and this has ganglion with each segment. It's kind of like our spinal cord. But it runs up the animal. This is synaptic, activating the second order neuron now. This is an interneuron. That interneuron goes to a motor neuron. And that motor neuron goes to the muscles to allow it to contract. This connection here from the interneuron to the motor neuron is a gap junction. So think about the speed of that synapse. So electrical signal from the sensory neuron to then the interneuron, chemical transmitted, acetylcholine, so transmitter has to go across the synapse, we'll talk about that, it takes a little time. But then after you activate the interneuron, if you have a gap junction to the motor neuron, boom, that's fast, right? And then the motor neuron to the muscle, that uses a chemical transmission, and that's glutamate. Now, some of you might have taken psychology classes, and maybe brain and behavior, have you taken brain and behavior yet? What's the neurotransmitter at our neuromuscular junction? Acetylcholine. What's the transmitter in the majority of animals in the world at their neuromuscular junction? Glutamate, exactly. They used to kind of mess that up. Because insects and crustaceans, if you just look at the species of beetles across the world, there's more species of beetles than the other animal, right? The neuromuscular junction transmitter in many invertebrates is glutamate. All right, so that's a chemical transmit. That's a little bit slow. So this neural circuit for that behavior, touch the tail, watch a tail flip up in the air, and you know it can tail flip and get away from something touching the tail, right? That's the idea. And then it goes somewhere else, away from the predator. That behavior was discovered in the 1970s, discovered in the sense of understanding every neuron in the circuit where they recorded. That was the first behavior described from neuron to neuron to neuron. And it was so well recognized by Don Kennedy in the 1970s at Stanford. He became president of Stanford University for 10 years. And this was the first behavior explained within a neural circuit. And you could actually do it cut off from the brain, from the animal, right? Because if you take a crayfish tail like we had upstairs and we pinched it on the tail, we could activate the circuit. And people still today, there's people left over from Don Kennedy, all his students, that still study the circuit today to understand how the circuit works and how gap junctions work. How do you think they first figured out the ion, the size of the pore between these gap junctions, between these cells for the gap junctions? Any idea? They didn't take that part out of our brain. They took it out of some animal, right? Maybe. And did these experiments, right? Inject a dye, like this maybe, probably. And this is exactly what they did. And the animal they used it in, Well, lobster preparation. We can thank the people at Harvard, actually Ed Kravitz, that used the lobster preparation, the same circuit, putting dye in here and seeing what goes in the motor neuron for understanding how gap junctions work and their limitations on the size of these gap junctions. And that work in the lobster led us to understand how gap junctions work in our liver, in our smooth muscles, and where else? Our heart, for carrying electrical signals and the limitations and what allows certain ions to go through or not. Crustacean preparation, invertebrates, really, you know, understanding the comparative physiology is very important. Okay, so some just general ideas of the anatomy of a neuron, which you all have heard before, and relating it like that circuit, cell body, axon, you know, terminals, right? Could be onto a muscle, could be onto another neuron. And those little processes off the back of that soma are the dendritic tree. This would be an example of your alpha motor neuron in your spinal cord. And then the synapses coming onto that dendritic tree, you know, interneurons that are synapsing onto those. But not all cells look this way. And this is a big misconception that a lot of people have. So think about this. Pinch your skin, right? Touch your skin. How is it that you perceive that? Or how is it that it stimulated those neurons? Any idea? I'm touching this. Was it a chemical? Did a chemical go through my finger to the other skin? Exactly, free nerve endings. Mechanistically, let's go down to the membrane now. How is it you excited that neuron, those pressure receptors? What is it that we're referring to on those receptors? What are those receptors? They're made up out of what you said before, the same as voltage-gated channels. Amino acids, proteins, right? So you're right on the right idea. So think of your finger, you know, as the free ending, like you said, maybe in your skin, free endings are for pain, pretty much, or Purkinje corpuscles, other sensory neurons. But if you touch that, let's say that's the sensory ending, how is it that it turns into an electrical signal? Think of the protein in that membrane, the ion channel, that detects what? Conformational change. It's a stretch-activated ion channel. Stretch-activated ion channel. So you deform that membrane, that protein that's in there, detects that deformation. It opens up conformational change, and what's going to happen? Ions are going to move across it and excite it. It gets above a threshold, right? And boom, it's an action potential. Where's the cell body for that sensory neuron when you're touching your skin? Where's the cell body? And where? In the muscle. And this is the sensory neurons on your skin. I could take away the muscle and you could just touch the skin. You're going to feel that. Where's the cell body? Isn't it part in your spine? Close to it. Close to your spine. But the cell body itself, you know, for just touching your skin, pinching your skin. Where's the cell body for that? Just below the skin? It isn't in vertebrates. Most of the sensory receptors, the sensory endings, the soma is very close to where the sensory ending is. But in us, the cell body for this touch is in our dorsal root ganglion, far away, close to the spinal cord, right? Outside of the vertebrae, dorsal root ganglion. So do we want a graded response, a small electrical response, to travel all that way up to our dorsal root ganglion and then into our spinal cord? We want an action potential initiated way out there by the sensory ending. So sometimes this is confusing to people because we're talking about spike initiation here. What do we mean by spike initiation? This is action potential. A spike, by definition, is an extracellular recording of an action potential. So we recorded spikes upstairs when we had that nerve on there, when we were pushing it. Extracellular recording, those are spikes that we were recording. But what they're resulting from is action potentials, right, from the nerve. Well, here, there's a lot of voltage-gated sodium channels. This is where the action potential is initiated, right? So a graded response comes down. It goes to a certain membrane potential. Then, boom, all these voltage-gated sodium channels open up because you went up to some voltage across the membrane. Sodium rushes in and generates an action potential that travels down this axon. We can't have that in our sensory neurons because that graded response would decay before it got to the spike, the axon hillock of our sensory neurons. So we need an action potential initiated close to the sensory endings. So on our sensory endings, like those free endings, we have some voltage-gated channels very close to that. And then if we get above a depolarization, that they can open up. But then we get an action potential that travels up that long axon, past the cell body, and then into lumbar spinal cord. So this sometimes is confusing to people because it's, you always think the cell body has to be close to that sensory ending, but it's not in the case of like our action potential. And why you need action potentials? Because it's so big, then it can travel down the axon and it doesn't decay by the time it gets to the ending where it needs to release transmitter, like signal in your brain that you're being pinched on your skin. Oh, the cockroach prep. I hear that you're going to get to use the cockroach prep in the labs. It's going to be great. You're going to love it. You're going to get grossed out. But you're probably going to use backyard brains and use these limbs that are cut off. Cricket preps are really good, too. And you probably won't be doing this, but we've done this for the neurophys class in the past, is that when you catch a cockroach, don't be too grossed out. Don't step on it too quick. Yeah, try to catch it. Pick it up. And you'll see these structures off the back. They're called cerci. And you wonder why you can't step on that cockroach, right? If it's healthy, if you see it out in the light, it's sick and it's dying because they usually won't be out in the light where you can see them. But come out at night in the halls of biology building, tons of cockroaches. And so when you go try to step on it, you can't step on it, right? It goes the other way. It's amazing. You can cut off the head and guess what? It will still have that reflex. Bizarre, right? And it's because of these little hairs on these cerci. There's little hairs down here. And it's so sensitive that if we put a suction electrode around this nerve, just like we did with that sensory receptor upstairs, and we had it sitting here on the table, I could stand back here and just go like that. And then in just a little while later, you're going to hear, and it goes down. It's so sensitive. So it can detect that wind vibration, these little hairs, fire, send the signal to the ventral nerve cord, chemical transmission, activate motor neurons, and it goes the opposite direction from the sensory input. And it actually measures the delay of the stimulation from this side to that side. And it knows which way the wind pulse is coming. That's pretty cool, right? And you can pop off its head and it can still do that. So it's like a Mighty Python movie, a headless cockroach that, you know, can actually run away from you. Phenomenal. This cockroach preparation is really amazing. It was used for more than 10 years by the leaders in pharmaceutical industries. Hoffman, LaRoche, Sandoz, and Ciba-Geigy. These are billion-dollar companies. Why do they use the cockroach preparation? It's cheap, it's easy, but also they develop not just pharmaceuticals for us, but they develop insecticides. And they wanted to understand how to kill the cockroach. When you first put on insecticides in the cockroach isn't moving. And it's dead. And what did they think about? They thought, oh, how does an insecticide work? Anybody know? Generally, like a carbachol insecticide, ones you spray around your house and your dishes and everything, and you're breathing. Bad stuff. But it actually works, a lot of them work by, some of them are sodium channel blockers, and the other group that people use. You think about your skeletal neuromuscular junction. You release acetylcholine, right? And it goes across the synaptic cleft, and it binds to these receptors, and it depolarizes the cell. And if it goes above threshold, boom, you get an action potential, and it travels along the muscle, and your muscle contracts, right? It's a general idea. Well, there's enzymes in here that chew up acetylcholine. It's called acetylcholine esterase. Insecticides are nerve gas agents. You worry about North Korea. Well, nerve gas agents are what we have down in Richmond, Kentucky, at the Bluegrass Army Depot, a ton, stockpile of nerve gas agents. And it's the same nerve gas agents that do this. They block the acetylcholine esterase, the enzyme that chews up acetylcholine. Why do we want to chew up acetylcholine in the synapse? Any idea?
So it'll stop firing.
So it'll stop exciting the cell. But actually what happens, it's very good. So acetylcholine comes across, binds to these receptors. These open up, allow sodium to go in, some potassium to go out, okay? And that excites the cell. But if acetylcholine stays bound to those receptors, they desensitize. They're not sensitive to acetylcholine anymore. But acetylcholine's still there, right? So if it stays bound, they can't respond to any more acetylcholine. They desensitize. So the idea is you have to get acetylcholine out of there so the receptor can go back to a normal state so it can bind acetylcholine again and be active. So the idea of the enzyme in normal in us is to get rid of this acetylcholine, and then it's actually cleaved, and some of it's taken back up in the nerve terminal, and then it goes away, and then it comes off of the receptor, and the receptor can be ready to be activated again. So if you keep acetylcholine there, they'll be inactivated. If they're inactivated, the muscle's not contracting because it opens up, excites the muscle cell, then it closes and stays in a state of inactivation until the acetylcholine comes off, and then it can be ready to be activated again. So what's going to happen? If you block the enzyme, you get a ton of acetylcholine here. So initially, you get excitation, but then you get total relaxation because you have too much acetylcholine, it's not getting away. And if you can't excite your diaphragm and your intercostals, what happens to your breathing? Right? You die. So this is how insecticides work. This is how nerve gas agents work as well. So it's very important when you spray that around your house and around your dishes. A lot of kids die every year from insecticides. And this is why they die. They usually die of asphyxiation. They can't breathe anymore. So it's really important to understand these, the desensitization over time.
Now, the cockroaches, other insects, they have the trachea that just come through skin. So
that's for breathing, right? That's very important. So very important, because then when people put insecticides on cockroaches, they thought, oh, we're blocking the neuromuscular junction, that's why they can't breathe, they can't function anymore, and they're not crawling, right? And you can step on them or they'll die because they can't eat. Well, it was really interesting because these people at Sibagaigi in Basel, Switzerland, actually were doing this work, and they were recording, stimulating the nerve and recording the muscle fiber and put on insecticides, and the preps were still just fine. Neuromuscular junction was working just great. Guess what? They forgot to read the old literature that was done even earlier than that, that these neuromuscular junctions are glutaminergic, and that that insecticide you could put on a crap load and won't do anything to the neuromuscular junction. That wasn't killing the insects. What was killing the insects is blocking the sensory nerve activity into the CNS. This is cholinergic. And when you block this and you can't function anymore, it couldn't get the sensory input and it couldn't respond anymore to, you know, stimuli or have no sensory perception anymore. And that's what kills them. So for insecticides and cockroaches, or insects, it's usually the sensory activity damaging that input into that preparation. It goes way back to the crayfish preparation in the 70s, which was really worked out and all this. So you begin to understand, if you're looking for summer jobs, for example, Eli Lilly, right up the road, they make insecticides too. You understand more about neurobiology and neurophysiology and some of this history, you can apply for these summer fellowships. They'd be happy that you know some of these work, right? They make a lot of pharmaceutical company industry as well for work. Okay, so what we're talking about, like what we just did, and this is that misconception again from like ours, is that sensory stimuli on the skin, for example, graded response and then an action potential traveling, but our cell body is a dorsal root ganglion, far away from that. But in many insects and invertebrates, the cell body is very close to the sensory ending. So if you stimulate that hairs on the end of that crayfish tail or cuticle stress detectors, you have that graded response, but you'll get an action potential relatively quickly, and that action potential travels, can release transmitter onto an inner neuron, and then onto, say, another neuron, or onto a muscle fiber, for example. So the idea is graded responses, getting to produce an action potential. The action potential is produced because of a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels. All right, high density of voltage-gated sodium channels in one region. So if that high density of voltage-gated sodium channels was up here, in the endings, well, you could generate your action potential up here then, and then travel down. Okay, so it just depends where the location is. But generally, we think of site of spike initiation in what's called this axon hillock, because we're kind of in that mindset of an alpha motor neuron, like in our spinal cord. All right. So that just gets you some idea of the connections. Now, what we did upstairs, we recorded an intracellular recording. And we did it across with this microelectrode that we stabbed. So we had a saline bath. We had a ground wire in the saline. We zeroed it out. And then we stabbed into the cell. And we got a resting membrane potential. So you start off at zero. You stab it. Boom. You get some negative value. Minus whatever, 70 or 60, whatever that was in that prep. Well, why is it minus 60? Or why is it minus 70? In your body, all your cells have different resting membrane potentials. Your neurons, some neurons might be minus 70. Your skeletal muscle is probably minus 60. Some of your heart cells for pacemaker don't really have a resting membrane potential because they're always pacing. But if you stopped it from pacing, it might only be minus 20. So it depends on the cell. But why are all these cells different? And to understand that, we have to do the physiology, right? And if it's abnormal, then it's a pathological condition. So what makes the resting membrane potential what it is for a cell? It's going to change the excitability of that cell also. So we have to understand some of the early experiments. Now, the early experiments came really through that squid axon. Taking that squid axon, switching the solution on the inside, switching it in the bath, and then finding out how you can excite the cell. And when they did these experiments, they could depolarize the cell a little bit and get something like this. If they did a little bit more, they got up to a certain level, and boom, they got that action potential. And it took them a long time to figure out why all of a sudden you got that big action potential, and what is it due to? What ions are causing that electrical response? Well, it took them years to try to figure out that there must be something magical about depolarizing to this one level, then all of a sudden getting all these ions to flow into the cell. So then they postulated there must be some kind of gate or something that just knows that membrane potential. And then they postulated that there must be channels that are voltage gated. So many experiments to actually come up with this idea, and that's what we call threshold. When these voltage gated sodium channels open, you fire an action potential. If you put in like a negative current, you can see this negative membrane potential. But you don't get these action potentials in the negative fashion. So people tried to understand this. People tried to understand after an action potential, why does it go below the resting membrane potential and then come back up? So it took them years to really understand this. And from that, they discovered many types of channels. I know this is a little bit hard to read, and this is just a short list. There's many types of channels, but just to get the idea, we've been talking about voltage-gated sodium channels. So it's limited, like I, sodium is the current for sodium. Leak channels, mostly potassium. That means at rest, you have these channels that are open and they're leaking to potassium. But your sodium-potassium pump keeps that level at a certain level for inside the cell and outside the cell. You have voltage-gated calcium channels, like in your heart or your nerve terminals at your neuromuscular junction. You have channels that are activated by calcium coming in and then activating a potassium channel. Isn't that weird? Calcium coming into the cell and then works in the channel to open it up, a potassium channel. That's bizarre. So now you have two channels, two times the things that could go wrong, right? The calcium coming in as well as that potassium channel. So that's kind of neat too. And we need these to understand how our heart works as well. And then there's other, you know, voltage-gated potassium channels, the key ones. Channels, like we said, are like resistors across the membrane. If they're closed, you get a high resistance. If they're open, low resistance. That means ions can go through. So people model membranes by electrical circuits, like a resistor or a capacitor that can store charge. So a capacitor, a resistor, you open up the channel, ions move, the resistor's low. So you might see in some textbook a resistor like this with an arrow across it. If the arrow's across it, that means it's a variable resistor. Okay, that means it, like a voltage-gated channel that can open. This is like a leak channel that just stays open, right? But if you have an arrow across there, the one that's closed and then opens, it's a variable resistor. Just so you get used to the terminology and seeing things. Okay. So how are cells excitable? Ion movements. Why do we have a resting membrane potential the way we do? Well, it's due to the imbalance of the ions, particularly potassium. And so this potassium, you know, it's no different than this experiment here. If you have a high concentration over here and a low concentration over here, of course it wants to dilute, right, and move potassium over here to this side, or maybe water over to this side because it's higher osmolarity, right? So, you know, think about both the osmotic problems. But in time, it's going to balance out. Well, what if we put a charge across here? What if we make one pole negative and the other pole positive? What's going to happen? If this one's negative, it's going to be more attracted to the positive ions are going to be more attracted over here, right? And if this is positive, then more than negative ions will be attracted over here. And that's what happens in your cell as well. If the cell is negative on the inside, it's going to be more attracted to the positive ions to come in and kind of repel the chloride from coming in, right? Based on the electrical gradient. But it also depends on the concentration gradient, right, for the cell. So it's a balance of the electrical chemical gradient. And this is what they did in the squid axon to figure this out. So the equation that they used to work on this, to figure out like the upstroke of the action potential, they actually solved this by changing the ion concentrations and working it out. And they used the Nernst equation. Now you might just freak out because it's a little bit of math, but it's not so bad. Right? So just think about the equilibrium for an ion. okay, equals RT, I'm just going to put this up there, ZF ln times the concentration of these ions on one side or the other. Let's just put out over N for now because it will relate to the cell. Let's use it for potassium. Okay. Potassium on the inside of a cell is what? Maybe, I don't know, 5 millivolts, millimolar. What's the potassium? No, yeah, on the outside here, right? Out. And on the inside, we said maybe 120. Let's do 120. Okay, millimolar. Okay, so we could actually work that out. Now, to make it a little bit easier, we can actually look at some of these values that appear. R is a gas constant. You don't have to memorize this, just that you realize it's a constant. It's a gas constant used in chemistry, if you remember all that stuff. I haven't purged it all yet. T is in temperature in Kelvin. So you can work it out in Kelvin. F is Faraday's constant, Michael Faraday. It's a constant, right? And Z is the charge of the ion. So in this case, it's plus 1, right? So if these are constants, and you do your experiment at a particular temperature, you don't have to put that in the formula every time, right? So I actually had some numbers before, and I probably forgot it. But I think it's around at 18 degrees C, centigrade, for example, this is around 0.058 volts here, okay? And then you can convert the ln to log, makes it easier, log base 10. All right, so let's see. Anybody have a calculator and iPhone on you? What's log base 10? Let's do this. Let's do 5. And you can work this out yourself on equations. 5 divided by 120 equals 0.041. Is that what y'all get? Okay. And we're going to do a log. So you have to turn your iPhone sideways to get logs, right? Log base 10 minus 1.38. But we're going to times it by 0.058 because that's that times 0.058 equals minus 0.08. Minus 0.08. Did I do that right? Yes. So this is 8, that's volts. So this is actually 80 millivolts. Minus 80 millivolts. So based on this concentration gradient, we have an electrical gradient of, say, minus 80 millivolts. All right, we get the idea? That concentration gradient set up a potential of minus 80 millivolts across that membrane, or 80 millivolts absolute across the membrane. If we change this, it's going to change this equilibrium potential. So another way to think about the Nernst equation is what? Let's put the same concentration of salts on both sides. Let's put the electrodes in, and let's drive it to be have an 80 millivolt difference between the two sides. You could do that experiment. And what's going to happen? You're going to get a concentration gradient of this. So you see how this works. It's the electrical chemical gradient. And the equilibrium potential is when you have no net flux. So at this potential is when you have no more ionic movement for that ion. It's the equilibrium potential for that ion. So they work this out for the resting membrane potentials. And well, we just solved it for potassium. So let's just draw on the board over here. E potassium. Maybe minus 80 millivolts. Okay. The E sodium, if you figure that one out, and you probably figured it out already, remember it's high on the outside compared to the inside, it could be at a very plus value, like plus 35 millivolts. Very different, right? What's the resting membrane potential like we measured upstairs? Maybe minus 60 something? So we have minus 60 RP, minus 60 millivolts. Wow, it's not up here at plus 35. It's close to the what? It's close to the E potassium. So it's more driven by potassium equilibrium than it is sodium equilibrium. If we looked at calcium, since calcium is so high on the outside compared to the inside, it could be at plus 120 millivolts. That means there's a lot of driving gradient from minus 60 to plus 35. That's 60 plus 35. That's 95 millivolt driving gradient, right? That's a big driving gradient. So when voltage-gated sodium channels open, there's a big driving gradient for sodium to go inside that cell to get up to the equilibrium potential of sodium. And even a greater driving gradient to get up to calcium, the calcium channel open. So you see the potential there is driven by these equilibrium potentials and where you are for that cell at rest. I know that's kind of hard to, you know, maybe get in, but you get the idea of the gradients now. Some cells are right at the E-potassium. So this is interesting. What they've worked out for kind of making it short time is you can have the resting membrane potential, I'll call RP, and potassium concentration outside the cell. As you raise potassium concentration outside the cell, and you do this kind of experiments that we did upstairs, let's say your membrane potential starts off at minus 60 millivolts, you will start to get zero, you know, millivolts. You will start to get that resting membrane potential to go less negative, more depolarized as you raise potassium outside. That means the resting membrane potential is driven by potassium. And it means that the leak channels are potassium channels, mostly. The cells are permeable to potassium at rest. How do you work all that out? Well, back to this equation, right? The Nernst equation. So it's kind of interesting. Now, why is it that if you do this experiment, but if you do it theoretically for the Nernst equation, you put the Nernst equation in, it's usually a little bit off. It's a little bit off. It's not as... So this is theoretical, and this is experimental. Why might experimental and theoretical be different? If you work out the theoretical equation, it doesn't quite match the experimental as you raise potassium outside. Well, is potassium the only ion that leaks across the membrane? No. It's sodium as well. So they came up with a second equation called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. GHK. If you want a good tattoo, Nernst equation is a great tattoo. Another one is Ohm's Law. You know, instead of the butterfly, you get these things. Okay. So this one is for multiple ions. And what they did here is they basically took RT over ZF, converted to log, and now worked out the permeability for like potassium, permeability for potassium this way, out over in, plus the permeability for sodium, plus the times the permeability times the concentration of sodium out over the concentration of sodium on the inside. And you keep doing this for other ions. So now, the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, take-home message, works on permeability of the ion channels, which wasn't used in the Nernst equation, right? There's no permeability here. This is assuming that the membrane's permeable, like a leak channel. But now you actually can measure the permeability of the ions times the concentration of the ions and take in other ions. So two things to think about the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Permeability is taken in and multiple ions. And now if you plug in these other concentrations and you know the permeability factors, you now can understand where the experimental equation will match the new theoretical equation by the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Katz won a Nobel Prize. He won a Nobel Prize not so much for synaptic transmission, but understanding the shape of the action potential. So when we think of the shape of the action potential, remember, like in your skeletal muscle, let's say it's minus 60, and if you're right underneath the nerve end plate, you can get a depolarization when the transmitter is released from acetylcholine, opening up those channels, right? They open up, sodium goes in, a little potassium comes out. You get a depolarization. But then all of a sudden, what happens? You get above a threshold of opening up what? A lot of voltage-gated sodium channels. And boom, all those channels open up. And what happens? Sodium rushes in. And where does it want to go? To the E sodium, way up here, at plus 35. Right? It wants to go to the equilibrium potential. So you get this gigantic influx of sodium, and it's driven to go to the equilibrium potential. It doesn't quite make it. It doesn't quite make it, and it comes back down. Why doesn't it quite make it? Any ideas? Standardized test questions. If you're interested in allied health, those will be on the MCAT, DCAT, all those things, PCATs.
Because
potassium will start going out. Because why? There's another threshold, which we don't really think about that much. This was the threshold for the voltage-gated sodium channels. There is another threshold for the voltage-gated potassium channels. they have a much higher threshold. So as we depolarize the membrane, all of a sudden potassium channels start to open. Which way is potassium going to go? Potassium's high inside the cell. And where's the equilibrium potential? Way down here, minus 80. You know, let's do it over here. Minus 80. So when you open up potassium, where does the membrane potential want to go? To minus 80. So it starts to counteract the sodium going in, and potassium now going out, positive charge going out, makes the cell more negative, and so it wants to come back down. But there's something else that's unusual about voltage-gated sodium channels. After they open and sodium rushes in, they're kind of like those acetylcholine receptors at your muscle. They go into a state of called inactivation. So they open, it's a protein, right? Voltage started open. They opened. Sodium rushes in. But as the sodium rushes in, they stay open just for a little while, and they change their conformation, and they go into an inactive state. They don't reopen. They're not reactivated until the membrane potential comes back to rest for a certain amount of time. And then the conformation changes back, and now it's ready to be activated again. So sodium channels are inactivating here. Inactivation of sodium channels, so you can't get up to E-sodium because the sodium channels are inactivating, potassium channels are opening, and now as you inactivate more sodium channels, they're not open anymore, they're all closing, and now potassium is the dominant current. And you come back down towards the E-potassium level, which could be below the resting membrane potential. And that's the whole reason you come down below the resting membrane potential in some cells. Because the E's potassium is below the resting membrane potential, right? And potassium channels, the voltage-gated potassium channels, don't show that kind of inactivation so quickly. Some types do, but the general ones for what we're talking about don't. So what happens is you come down to the E potassium, you hyperpolarized, but what opened them in the first place? Voltage way up here. Are we up here anymore? No. So what's going to happen to the channels? They start to close. They start to close. You come back to the resting membrane potential. That's the action potential, all right? That was all solved by Golden, Hodgkin, and Katz. And they came up with this equation from working out the currents that go across the membrane, and they did all that on the squid axon. When they did this with partial differential equations. You know, your Cal-3, Cal-4 level stuff. And it took them a year to work out with partial differential equations the upstroke of the action potential. And they were interviewing Bernard Katz, and they were saying, well, how long do you think it's going to take you to work out all the ionic current and flow on the downward stroke? And his response was, I think I have some mass shortcuts, and it'll only take me another 6 months. Whew, can you imagine? And then they came up with this whole equation by looking out permeabilities and deriving these, and then doing experimentation to test it. And this is how we come up with the shape of the action potential. And know that the upstroke is due to sodium and the downstroke is due to potassium. And that we know that the permeability changes of these ions as you go through here and down because of the channels opening or closing. That's a lot of work, right? But they did all that back in the 1950s without computers, hands, math, paper, you know, the old-fashioned way, sit your ass in a chair and study kind of thing. Okay, so this is what they've worked out, that kind of stuff, the Nernst equation and the experimental and then solving these problems. All right. And again, the sodium-potassium pump is the one that keeps it all back in balance. If you poison the pump in a cell, what's going to happen? You poison that pump in the cell, it will slowly depolarize. Slowly depolarize. Because you can't maintain that potential anymore. It will slowly depolarize. Because you're not keeping that balance anymore of a higher potassium inside the cell. So if you happen to not breathe, right, hold your breath, can't get oxygen in, that oxygen is needed for what? Why do we breathe? What do we need oxygen for? Why do we need oxygen? ATP production, right? In the electron transport chain. If we can't make the ATP, well, can't we keep going? We can't keep the sodium-potassium pump going. The most driven, energy-demanding process in your body probably right now. If you can't keep that going, you can't keep the ion balance going. If you can't keep the ion balance going, you can't keep your membrane potential. And you're going to start depolarizing. As you depolarize slowly, if you change this equation for this a little bit, and you slowly depolarize, guess what? You won't get an action potential at the same threshold. Because as you open up a few voltage-gated sodium channels, they inactivate, 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 right? So if you slowly depolarize a cell, you can change the threshold to a different level to get an action potential. But if you slowly depolarize your neurons or your heart, you change the excitability to get an action potential. It's kind of neat to think about, right? So you need these things fast, right? And you need them to get back to a resting state so you can be activated again. So this is the whole shape of the action potential, which we just talked about. Sodium, potassium coming down because of the equilibrium potassium below that. And a lot of it, you know, hum to the, you know, squid gods. All right, because they could do all that kind of work on the squid axon. Phenomenal. And they worked out the shape of these action potentials. And they know now that, you know, this is due to sodium conductance coming into the cell. And this is conductance, so it's a little confusing. It's not current. But this conductance of potassium is high on the downstroke because you opened up voltage-gated potassium channels. And they've worked this out with decreasing the sodium outside the cell, and you've dampened the shape of your action potential. Because now they could test this and show, and they put it back, and you get back your nice shaped action potential. We've had undergraduates do that in the lab with crayfish axons and reproduce the same type of curves. Pretty cool. So the idea of these, I don't want to get too involved in this, but here's an experiment that they do in neurophysiology. You can actually experimentally, with that squid axon, step the voltage up, right, to a certain value, because you have an electrode on the inside and the outside of the membrane. You can drive the potential wherever you want. And they measured the currents. This is how they figured this out. They could measure the currents. If you do it for all the currents, they would first see an inward current followed by an outward current. If they put some blockers on for sodium channels, like TTX, the pufferfish, you know, the pufferfish, TTX, tetrodotoxin, it blocks voltage-gated sodium channels. That's why you have that tingling feeling in your mouth. Eat too much, you die, right? And so the TTX will block voltage-gated sodium channels. If you put TTX on and you redo that experiment, you get that purple curve. So you subtract the two away from each other, and now you have the sodium current. That's just how they did these experiments. It's really cool, right? Understanding then doing this. And they could reverse this and then block the potassium channels with other potassium blockers that block voltage-gated potassium channels, subtract that out, and you would have only the potassium current. So it's really kind of neat how these experiments were done in understanding these currents. Now, here's something that we're going to put together what we just learned. You repetitively stimulate your neuron. How fast can you stimulate your neuron and carry that electrical signal? How fast can you respond to multiple touches to know that that's repetitive and what frequency that's stimulating? What's your limits of that sensory perception? And what drives it? Is it the mechanical transformation of that ion channel, right, the stretch-activated ion channel? Or is it the electrical signals? So if you repetitively stimulate an axon, stimulate once, stimulate twice, you only got the one potential. If you stimulate once and you wait some time and you stimulate again, you can get that activity. As you go closer to the first stimulus, the second stimulus is much smaller. What does this do to? Anybody remember? Tori. Yes? Pardon? Well, kind of like desensitization. Sorry to put you on the spot. Pardon? In a sense. And what does it do to? What did we say happens here? Sodium channel inactivation. It takes time after they've opened. They go into that inactive state. It takes time back at rest before they're ready again. That time at rest before you can even initiate a second action potential is called the absolute refractory period. That's your limitation. But you can start to get some response almost back to normal. This is called relative refractory period. This is when some of the sodium channels are back ready to be activated again. So this is your limitation of how fast you can stimulate or see that sensory perception or motor nerve activity or of your nervous system in general. Right? You can't get the, if you have too much activity going, you're going to be in that state of inactivation. So this is what limits our abilities as well. All right, and some cells, just think about some cells, you can do this, and you only get that one potential. Some other cells, you can do this, same response, and you get multiple potentials. What's the difference? Why are some cells can respond multiply, and some cells not? It's the density of the types of ion channels you have in that cell membrane. If you have more voltage-gated potassium channels, or fewer voltage-gated sodium channels, or maybe some other, maybe it has more pumps that can reset itself faster. Who knows? There's lots of different differences among the different neuronal types. Some can respond repetitively, and people have worked that out with some of the wonderful invertebrate neural preparations, like the leech nervous system. Actually, the leech, can you believe it? The blood-sucking, ugly leech. Actually, the nervous system is really beautiful in there, and they can take out the individual neurons, and they studied this particular difference to understand how your brain works, how your neurons work in your brain. They actually used invertebrate preparations. All right. So it's kind of neat to think about. And that's everything we talked about there. Other techniques that are used instead of extracellular or across the membrane with intracellular, there's this other technique, and this technique won these people a Nobel Prize, Bert Sockmann and Edwin Nair. And Nair was at the University of Washington. They're both Germans. I think they're both back at Max Planck Institutes in Germany. But they were awarded the Nobel Prize for a technique, which is really quite neat, and that's the patch clamp technique. Why is this so important, the patch clamp technique? Well, instead of measuring the membrane potential across an intracellular recording, which really the intracellular electrode was only, I think, created up in Chicago by Ling and Gerling, I believe, in 59. And before then, all you could do is really the squid axon with an electrode on the inside because it's so big and one on the outside. But when they developed the micro electrode, that glass electrode that we looked at, they could then measure the membrane potential across cells. That's the first time, not that long ago, you know, to really record across membranes. And that really changed everything. Then you think about, well, those currents that we were looking at, like, you know, these currents, what are they carried by? If we step that voltage up and we opened up a whole bunch of voltage-gated sodium channels, these are the individual channels opening, right? And sodium going into the cell through an individual channel. But this is a composite of many channels opening. Why is it not faster? Why is it a little bit, you know, got the slope to it? Well, not all the channels open immediately at once, right? And some are a little sluggish, some close. And then why is this inactivation? What is this inactivation? You know, what does it do to mechanistically those gates turning and closing? How do they function at a channel level? It's hard to understand that when you're across the whole membrane. So this technique, by recording from single channels and putting a voltage across there, you could understand single channel properties and understand how they work. From that, a lot of understanding of pathologies in human diseases came about, because then they could understand the channels aren't working right. There's something wrong with the channel. The conductance isn't right. They're more conductive to different ions, not the appropriate ions. There's a guy that I went to grad school with at Texas Tech, and he became a faculty member at the University of Chicago. He's doing such cool work. I'm so jealous of him. He's actually working at the University of Chicago, and what he was doing is working with clinicians. When an epileptic patient would come in and wouldn't respond to pharmacological agents, and some of these pharmacological agents are really bad. I mean, for what they're actually using in some cases when they can't treat them with other aspects, they use calcium channel blockers to keep the nervous system from not being active. Well, you can imagine if you have calcium channel blockers, you're not getting synaptic transmission, right? Your heart, side effects, you're, you know, basically living in the couch, and you're just, you know, wondering if life, quality of life is there. So, you know, that's the case for some people. So what they were going in is actually finding that focal spot in the brain of children, going in and removing neuronal tissue, taking it out, putting it in a culture dish, disassociating the cells, and call up Andrew, and it might be 2 in the morning, said, we got this patient in, we're doing this experiment, we got this going, he's having a seizure, we know where that focal point is, we're taking it out. And they would work day and night, 72 hours straight, the lab never shut down. They would record with channel recordings, patch clamp recordings, until they understood what channels are not working right. And then they would come up with a cocktail of drugs to then use, and then use it on that patient right there. Isn't that amazing? That is cool stuff. And then try to solve, by pharmacological agents, a targeted approach for that individual. That's really cool work. But a combination of those biophysicists, electrophysiologists, lab technicians, everybody working together to solve that problem. Everybody's in that circle. So if we look at a sodium channel, for example, you give a depolarization, you've activated them, they're voltage gated, they open up. This is the conductance, the current, for a single channel opening. And even though you still maintain that depolarization state, it closed. Wow. So now you can measure open time. Not only that, you can measure the amplitude of that current, and you can figure out how many sodium ions went into that cell. So now you know how many sodium ions go through that cell in an amount of time. Pretty cool. Do that experiment 100 times, repetitively. And then you average them together, and look what you get. What does that remind you of? Back to the whole cell response that we just looked at. So the individual channels make up what you can measure across that whole cell, and by understanding the single channel function. And that's why they got the Nobel Prize. They could really do a lot of work, plus the implications for understanding pathological situations. So that's really cool. There's a whole group in Chile, down in South America, that is very famous for, called black lipid membranes. They actually make membranes, different phospholipids, and they take the proteins of ion channels that they make, like in a frog oocyte, extract them out, and they can put them into the artificial membrane, and they can understand how channels work that way too. So there's other techniques used in neurophysiology to try to understand how ion channels work. And they're very good at this. But so they can measure open and closing times, how many channels are in a patch of membrane, because you know your patch electrode size. And look at this, one channel open, two channels open, three channels open, two channels, one channel, closed, one, two, closed, it's flickering. And then three channels. So at most, in that patch of membrane, they got three channels to open at once. So now you know the surface of that membrane, you just figured out channel ion density, channel density. Pretty cool. You take that along the cell, and you go to the axon hillock, and guess what you get? A lot of voltage-gated sodium channels, right? By physiological recordings. Nowadays, they can use antibody staining, too, and you can see that's really highlighted with voltage-gated sodium channel antibody, you know, like a fluorescent. But to actually understand if they're functional, that's different. You can use antibodies to acetylcholine receptors, a particular aspect, and you'll get staining that won't match the physiology. Why is that? Any ideas? So, antibody staining for a protein. It could be found in other places. It could be under the membrane surface. It's not in the membrane yet. It might be a degraded part. All these proteins have turnover, right? They don't stay there for the life of the cell. They're turning over, right? And they all have different rates of turnover. They're all being synthesized and turned over. As they're being used, they start to become old and not functional, you know, anymore. It's like an old bicycle. It gets rusty, right? And they actually get internalized and turn over. If you use some antibody staining, you're getting all of that. It might not be the functional response of those channels or those proteins. So that's why physiology is really important, not just the anatomy and not just the staining techniques. It's actually measuring those. As I said, you now know all the molecular sequence for many of these channels and understanding how they work. And one mutation in there, like not working right on the inactivation, can screw up your whole nervous system, right? One amino acid substitution, boom, doesn't work, you know? Or maybe you have something that changes up here, maybe a couple amino acids, but it doesn't affect it that much. So it all depends on the severity about where that change might be. So it's pretty cool. And you can model like the squid axon, and you can do these on breadboards. I just want to kind of show this idea of understanding. If you give a current injection, like right here, let's say this is the outside of this is the cell outside, and this is the cell inside, and this is the bilipid. So if you're thinking of a squid axon, think of it circulating like this. You can give current here, and you can measure the voltage. But as you measure the voltage down the axon, that voltage decays. This is why the same can happen in your neurons, too. If you don't have the ability to regenerate the action potential, you're going to get this graded, what's called cable properties of decay, right? And this is the same as a wire. If you took a wire from here and you went all the way across campus and you put a battery off here, are you going to measure the same voltage way over there? No, because of the cable properties. You have resistance in that wire, and you're going to lose that potential as you go along that wire. It's the same idea in the neuron, because you have leak. Right? You're leaking. Remember those leak channels? So your potential drops. So those leak channels are important. You can lose your potential. But if you have regions where there's voltage-gated sodium channels, what can you do? Rejuvenate the action potential, for example, right? So this is the idea of rejuvenating these action potentials as they travel, because you can't rely on the cable properties of the neuron, because you'll decrement your potential too much. kind of shown here, decrements over time if you don't reactivate like an action potential along the neuron. Okay, so, and this is where you reactivate your action potentials in, say, your myelinated nerves. There's a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels at these nodes of Ranvier, and then cable properties to the next node. But really, from node to node, you only drop about a millivolt. When your action potential is 70 millivolts, you got a lot of leeway. If you just drop one millivolt from node to node, it's not going to matter that much because you have such a leeway dropping this down to still be above threshold that you're going to initiate your next action potential. All right? So this is the idea behind that, of rejuvenating these responses. Okay, we can go on and on and on and on and on. But if we took a nerve out, like a frog's sciatic nerve or your sciatic nerve, put it in a dish, stimulate it over here, and record it over here with a field potential, right? Suction electrode, for example. You will get something like this. You will get a group of neurons that will conduct very fast down to the other end, your recording electrode. Boom. This is made up of many axons, right? A nerve has many neurons. A neuron is a single cell. So a nerve has hundreds or if not thousands of neurons. You stimulate at one end, you record in the other end. Well, this neuron was really fast. The next neuron was a little bit slower. And this group over here, the population, had about this much conduction velocity. But some of those were a little bit slower and slower. And then you had another group that conducted at a certain rate, and another group that conducted at another rate. And there's differences in the groups of neurons in your nerves for their conduction velocity. What makes them different? Some of the properties go back to what we were talking about with these properties of the neuron and how fast it can conduct, or maybe losing potential could even be part of the problem. Here's the answer. It's somewhat of the size of these axons, or if they're myelinated. If they're myelinated, they have those little nodes of Ranvier, right? And in those nodes are what? Voltage-gated sodium channels. Quickly come, boom, another action potential. So that's pretty good. But not only that, they don't lose much potential between the nodes because they have the insulation around the myelin. That myelin acts like insulation. Take a bare cable, and you know that you can short it out, right? That's why you have insulation on your house wires, right? Because you don't want the two wires touching each other. You don't want two neurons touching each other, too, as they're going traveling down, because this one will influence the neighboring one. So that insulation keeps it where it can travel very fast, and something called decreasing the capacitance. I don't want to get too involved in that, but the idea is that they can travel fast because of that insulation that's on that neuron. So the big axons can travel really fast. The small axons in diameter travel relatively slow. That's 4.2. And this happens to do about the size. So think about a garden hose versus a fire hose. All right, this is a way to remember this. Fire hose, big, right? Does it have much resistance for the flow to go through? No, relatively easy. But a garden hose is really small. It has a lot of resistance, right, for the water to flow through. So it's going to take it, and the resistance is back pressure basically on it, and it takes longer for the current to flow through. That's one idea behind these sizes. Unmyelinated means it doesn't have that insulation around there, and it actually loses the current as it goes down that wire. So you're going to lose more potential as you travel down that wire. So an unmyelinated axon has a very low conduction velocity. Fortunately, most of our motor neurons are myelinated, right? Fast conduction. Many invertebrates, we consider it unmyelinated, but they're not truly unmyelinated. They have some wrapping around them, but they can function there. These are neurons in your body. C fibers are like pain fibers. Slow conduction, right? And so these differences are like what you would have in your sciatic nerve, for example. All right, so I don't want to get too much more into this, but there's one last thing that I was supposed to cover, and that is synaptic transmission. So let's think about synaptic transmission. Let's look at a frog neuromuscular junction. Okay, so we have a frog neuromuscular junction. We took electron microscopy across their nerve terminal. This is the nerve terminal. This is the muscle. You see the contractile element. Inside that nerve terminal are little vesicles. And these little vesicles are really quite neat, because they contain the neurotransmitter. So, kind of to put all this really quick into perspective, let's look at these experiments of Bernard Katz. Everybody can just hum when you hear his name. Bernard Katz did this experiment, and it was really classic. So he actually did his first experiments in the crayfish preparation. Great. But then he went on to the frog preparation. And what he did is something really neat. This is before intracellular electrodes. This is extracellular electrodes. He took an extracellular electrode, and he recorded underneath the neuromuscular junction. And when he recorded underneath the neuromuscular junction without stimulating the nerve, he found these little bumps like this. Okay. But if he recorded over here, away from the neuromuscular junction, he barely got anything, maybe just these tiny little things. Okay, like that. Cable properties. That's the point here, cable properties. He's not stimulating the nerve, but there's these spontaneous things that are happening. You couldn't understand it. But mostly underneath the implant. And the further he got away, those would be much smaller and smaller. Well, then he stimulated the nerve. And what he found when he did that, if he stimulated, he got something that he could respond, and then boom, you know, get the action potential. Whoa. So then he understood, oh, these muscles are like the squid axon. There's voltage-gated sodium channels. They all open up. And boom, you got this big action potential. But he couldn't understand how the nerve terminal worked when you could then activate these voltage-gated sodium channels and get the action potential. So he did some really neat experiments. He did all his experiments below the threshold when he did stimulation. How could he do that? Remember the nerve terminal, if you remember maybe from freshman biology or so, that calcium comes in the nerve terminal and causes those vesicles to release. So I'll just kind of go through this. You get an action potential down the nerve terminal. Down here in the nerve terminal, there's special channels. These are voltage-gated calcium channels. So voltage-gated, depolarize the nerve terminal, calcium comes in. Calcium is magic. Magic. Okay, you can put that on your chest. Magic. It causes vesicles that are in the nerve terminal to fuse. When they fuse, they release the transmitter. So what's the limiting factor here? Well, if you have low calcium on the bath, you're not going to get calcium to come in. So he was really clever. He reduced the calcium outside the bath. He got less calcium to come in after he would stimulate. You'd have fewer vesicles to be released. So when he did these experiments in low calcium, he could then see these kind of responses. Maybe one time he did that, the next time he would get this. The next time, if he did really low calcium, he'd get something like that. So these are all stimulated. Okay? He did another experiment. He found out calcium channels would be blocked by magnesium. So he could raise the magnesium, and it would block more of the calcium, fewer vesicles to come in. Pretty neat experiments. Well, the take-home of all this is that he measured the amplitude of these events. So evoked events. Evoked events means you stimulate the nerve terminal, evoked. And you measure the frequency of their occurrences. Okay, so frequency. And then you would measure the amplitude of these things. Okay, like in millivolts. And so if he gave a lot of magnesium or low calcium, he would get many small events because there are fewer vesicles fused, right? So he would plot this histogram. And you get the idea. If he had some more calcium in there, he'd get bigger events. So it depends on his experiment. But he'd get something like this. Okay? And then maybe he would get a few big ones. So these are the amplitudes. This is bigger that direction. But what he found is that he had some frequency to these. And he thought, well, that's really neat. There's something unitary about this. And he came up with the idea. Well, what about if I don't stimulate the nerve terminal, but I just had these spontaneous events? So he went ahead and matched these spontaneous events and measured these amplitudes. And so he did another curve, frequency and amplitudes, and he did the histogram for them, and he got something like that. Well, he looked at that, and he found out, well, the mean amplitude here is around 0.5 millivolts. Whoa, there's something interesting about this. This is 0.5 millivolts. This one's 1 millivolt. This one's 1.5 millivolts. So he postulated from electrophysiological recordings. They did not have the anatomy back then. Electron microscopy hasn't been invented yet. That wasn't until the 60s. He did this in the 50s. By electrophysiological recordings, he predicted and made the quantal hypothesis. The quantal hypothesis is that transmitter is released in packets. He didn't know about vesicles. He didn't know about the nerve terminal. There was no electron microscopy. He had no idea. When electron microscopy came around, some of the first preparations they looked at was the neuromuscular junction of the frog, because so much work has been done in the physiology. And then they said, oh, these vesicles must be packaged with transmitter. And that's what this is giving. This is due to single vesicles spontaneously fusing. But when I stimulate with a nerve terminal and a lot of calcium comes in, many vesicles at once fuse. And that's why I got these bigger events that are composites of single vesicles. Pretty cool. This then broke the idea of calcium being important for our brain to function in synaptic transmission at the neuromuscular junction. Solved at the frog and the crayfish preparations initially with extracellular recordings. Then people still are doing intracellular recordings and doing all this over again and mapping out lots of different things about this idea. Pretty cool. And I know it's about time to break. But this is the idea and some of the history that goes on in neurobiology. And these kind of questions are still being asked today. If we understand these processes of vesicle dynamics, how many vesicles fuse at once, the rate of those, how come they're all at once, or maybe slow, right? You might understand neuronal differences and how the nervous system works, our disease states for people, right? If this isn't working right. Memory. What's memory? How does memory work? Isn't that wild? Real quick. So exciting. Take this frog or crayfish neuromuscular junction, repetitively stimulate it, but now you do an intracellular electrode. Low calcium. Especially the crayfish preparation, where it was first worked out in 1971, science paper. They repetitively stimulated. They got a little response, but you stimulate again, you got a bigger response, and a bigger response, and a bigger response, and then you stopped. Whoa! These are potentials in the membrane, non-spiking. These are sub-threshold. The more I stimulate, and if you do it at a faster frequency, these would get bigger faster. But if I wait a little while, it's back down to smaller again. So it depends on what happens before to make these responses bigger. So if it depends on what kind of activity I had before to drive this activity bigger, what do you have? Memory at a synaptic level. That was first worked out actually in the frog and the crayfish preparations, neuromuscular junction. And what the idea is behind that is this is called facilitation. The facilitation is due to residual calcium. So calcium comes in, calcium has to go out. But if you stimulate fast enough before calcium has a chance to be buffered and come back in, what do you do with the second pulse? You build up more calcium. And the calcium is key for vesicle fusion. So the second, third, fourth, you could get more vesicles to fuse, and you got a bigger postsynaptic response. This was the beginning of understanding synaptic memory at the neuromuscular junction of the crayfish and frog preparations. From that, a lot of things have been piled on afterwards. So just to kind of excite you with neurophysiology and what can be done and where the field's going, because this is the kind of idea of understanding how your nervous system works. Okay. That will all be on Echo and hopefully podcast. And in case you're bored or you haven't fallen asleep yet, you can always listen to this and it'll put you to sleep at night. So you don't have to pay me money for sleeping medication, but...